You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave thy message after the tone. Huzzah.
Hey, I'm married to a guy very into medieval things, so we're working our way through some medieval cookbooks, and got to the stew section, and all of a sudden a red flag was thrown up because there are no potatoes in any of the stews or any of the other recipes. And it kind of blew my mind. And I want to know how the potato became everybody's sweetheart vegetable.
Hello?
Hey, Taylor, it's Flora from ELT.
Hi, Flora.
So, medieval cookbooks, huh? How did you procure these? How did they come into your life?
They came with my husband when we got married. He is a medievalist, so we have a plethora of medieval literature in our house.
He's a medievalist?
Yeah, so he runs a business where he makes swords, armor, weaponry, leatherwork, you name it.
Okay, so he's like full bore on medieval times.
Yes, pretty much.
Do you have any of his cookbooks with you?
I do.
I just want to get a sense of what the recipes are like. Do you want to just page through to the chapter on boiling serfs?
Yeah, I think that's towards the end. So it's like Parisian porridge and poached eggs with mustard sauce. No, thank you. Stewed onions with raisins and egg. Ew.
This is exactly what I was picturing in a medieval cookbook.
I guess that's why they called it the Dark Ages.
So tell me about the recipe that inspired this call.
It's a Parisian hare stew. It was around his birthday, and we obviously couldn't go out for dinner the way we maybe normally would. So I was trying to like get him to pick something special that he wanted to make at home for dinner for his birthday. And that's what he picked.
Did you find Parisian hare?
No. Parisian hare is hard to come by in Minnesota. So we just, you know, we went with Wisconsin hare instead.
What else is in this stew?
So the hare, chopped onions, butter. And then this was the most interesting thing, is two slices of wheat bread that you toast and then you break up and crumble up into the stew to like thicken it.
Mm.
And then just like salt and pepper. And that was about it. But no potatoes. It's just such a staple ingredient in all of the stews that I've eaten in my life that it just felt like there was just this gaping hole in my stock pot and I wanted to fill it with a potato. So we had a whole debate about if I could add potatoes or not. It was like a lot of back and forth of like, well, it's not medieval. Yeah, but it'll taste better. Well, it's not medieval, but yeah, it'll taste better. Actually, we have like a post-it note on that recipe in the book. Don't put potatoes in it. Not historical.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's and the word no is underlined.
So what do you want to know?
I want to know, where were the potatoes? Because when I think of potatoes, I think of Europe or, you know, Ireland or the potato famine or all those things. And I just assumed that that's where potatoes came from.
Basically, what are the roots of this root vegetable?
Exactly, yeah. What is the journey of the potato?
Are you ready to hear some answers?
Oh, I am so ready.
Okay, so potatoes aren't in your cookbook because potatoes weren't in medieval Europe at all. They didn't appear in European root cellars until the medieval period was wrapping up in the 1500s. So how did the Papa Parvenu find its way onto dinner plates across the continent? Why is Europe now boiling over with gnocchi, pommes frites, and potato pancakes? The story starts in Peru.
Peru is the center of origin of the potato.
This is Maria Scarra.
Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Maria.
Maria's a plant biologist, and she's been on the potato trail for 50 years. And she said potatoes are native to the Andes. People started cultivating them on the shores of Lake Titicaca many, many years ago.
They originated as a cultivated crop when hunters and gatherers started to realize that they could replant these tubers about 8,000 years ago.
8,000 years ago. Potatoes are a very old crop.
Okay, so it's been a while. Potatoes have been around for more than a minute.
Yeah, and they took root from there, spreading throughout the Andes.
They were taken south to Chile and all the way north to Venezuela. And 2,000 years ago, you've already got potatoes growing everywhere in the Andes.
And these potatoes aren't all alike. They're not uniform brown blobs. Thousands of years of cultivation leads to tons of types of potatoes. Today, Peru is home to somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 different varieties of heirloom potato.
I can't even fathom like what a mountain of 2,000 to 4,000 potatoes would look like, let alone different varieties of those.
I'm going to help you fathom. So Peruvian potatoes, PPs, come in all shapes and sizes.
There's long and round, and Andean farmers separate them into male and female. So the long ones tend to be the male.
Is there anything genetic in that, or is it just like
oh, no, a of course not.
Metaphor?
It's only a humanizing thing they do. And they joke in the farm that the women prefer the long ones.
I'm with you now.
And then there's some that are shaped like cow's horns or like a croissant.
That's way more exciting than I'll take some baby reds.
Just wait till you see a picture. I'm going to send you one.
Okay.
And we'll put it on Instagram at ELT Show and then Spotify too. This is the PP family portrait.
Oh, what? What?
It goes from deep purple to yellow. And many are bicolored. So you have a purple stripe or red eyes.
This is amazing. Your food could look really pretty. Like whatever you prepare with these could just be like a gorgeous array of color.
And each one tastes slightly different. One will be more mealy, one will be more nutty, one will be more firm. And, you know, when you boil native potatoes, you probably have 10 different varieties in your pot. So it's like you're eating through several flavors.
Sounds delicious.
I know. Just think back to your hair stew thickened with crusty bread.
Doesn't that sound so appetizing?
While Europeans were savoring their thin hair gruel, people in the Andes were enjoying a tasty veggie that also had the advantage of coming fully loaded with nutrients.
Potatoes are actually a very complete food because it has proteins, vitamins, and minerals.
They're high in vitamin C, and some of the yellow-fleshed potatoes have vitamin A.
So nutritionally, if you eat potatoes several times a week, you won't have deficiencies that you would if you ate noodles or rice or bread.
No way. Really? I guess I always think of potatoes as just kind of like bland carbohydrate filler food.
On top of being nutritious, they're also efficient to grow. Farmers get a lot of banger for their mash. Potatoes produce more food than most other crops per unit of land.
So if you grow, say, a hectare of wheat, you can do the same amount of food in a third of that land if you grow potatoes.
Holy cow. They really are a superfood.
So they're nutritious, delicious, and productive. A pretty good recipe for building civilizations. By the 1400s, 10 million people lived in the region under Inca rule. And that growth was partly potato-powered.
The fact that it sustained populations easily would have fueled the Inca Empire and made it possible to have such a large population.
The potato was really influential.
But what shaped Andean history really was the Spanish conquest, no? I mean, who knows what would have happened if they wouldn't have come?
After the break, how the potato was pillaged from Peru and eventually found its way into stew pots across Europe.
It's pretty clear that absent the potato, the history of Europe would be really, really different.
How did the potato make its way from the Andes to European soil? We have just the man to explain, Charles Mann, a man who wrote a book about colonialism in which the potato features heavily.
Hey, Taylor, how are you?
Hey, Charles.
You are smarter than I am because I wasn't curious about the potato and its impact in history until I stumbled across it in researching this book.
I was just doing a little shoulder brush over here.
This is a small pat.
Yep. A little attagirl.
Okay. So the Spanish arrived in Peru in the early 1500s, and with the help of smallpox and other diseases, they killed millions of people living there. They also looted the Inca Empire. They wanted to send back gold and silver.
But if they don't find it, the other thing that could be valuable is if they can bring over a bunch of plants.
Plants, in part because at the time, many Europeans were facing starvation.
Europe doesn't really have an adequate food supply. And in fact, basically every 10 years or so, the whole continent would be afflicted by famine. And there are just zillions of localized famines where people were running out of food. And you can imagine the idea of all these new foods is pretty interesting. And so all of these guys are sent over with instructions. If you find new plants, tell us about it. And so that's where the potato comes in.
Potatoes are the lesser known loot stolen by colonizers.
Yeah, I do think it's like a part that's missing in the history books we all get in grade school, right? Like no one talks about how they went to steal plants, but they did. They stole everything, including plants.
Yes, exactly. So Spanish soldiers in Peru sent these strange, new to them, vegetables back to Spain. The first record of potatoes in Spain is in the 1570s.
They bring over a bunch of varieties.
Do people roll out the welcome wagon for potatoes when they come ashore?
No, because, you know, this is like nothing they had ever seen before. They have eyes. They're gross. You don't plant them from seed. Everything about them is weird. And you can imagine some guy whose, you know, family has been harvesting wheat or barley or what have you for generations. And then somebody presents them with this and they're like, you know, right.
Fair. I could totally see where you would be skeptical about, like, you want me to eat that?
There were also rumors that potatoes could give you fever, leprosy, and scrofula.
Whoa.
Which is just as bad as it sounds.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm good.
For all these reasons, when new potatoes came to the old world, they inspired bushels of tater haters. So if you were eating potatoes in the 1600s in Europe, you were probably someone who didn't have a choice. Like, for example, in some places, potatoes were only served to prisoners. But gradually, potato perceptions change. We can't give one person full credit for that, but one name does pop up a lot.
The big figure that gets talked about is this guy named Parmentier.
Antoine Augustine Parmentier.
Do we call him the Potato Prophet for short?
No, but we should.
It's way easier to say.
The Potato Prophet was a Parisian pharmacist, and while he was serving in the Seven Years' War, he was captured by Prussia, which is modern-day Germany. And as a prisoner, Parmentier starts to see the spud as lifeblood.
He is forced to eat them as a prisoner of war, and it keeps him very healthy. And, you know, for all you know, he loses weight and buffs up, but he's very enthusiastic. When Parmentier finally gets released, he marches back to Paris and becomes a potato proselyte. And it has something to do with him saying, "This saved my life," which he believed. "I am going to save everyone else's."
Parmentier thought potatoes were the solution to France's recurring famines.
He became obsessed.
He's like the Johnny Potato Seed.
Yes. And unlike Johnny, he got a real keen sense of PR. So he does things like he gets the king and Marie Antoinette to wear potato flowers in the lapels. You know, and of course, everybody follows the king. And so everybody in France is walking around with potato flowers on their lapels.
It's like a little badge of honor for the potato.
And Parmentier stages all kinds of pro-potato stunts. For instance, he also hosts a dinner with a bunch of influencers.
Supposedly, Benjamin Franklin is one of the people he invites to his all-potato dinner.
All-potato dinner?
Yeah. So there would be hash browns and baked potatoes. There would be potatoes wrapped around meat. You can even make potato pie.
I think I'd enjoy that dinner personally.
Yeah. I have some nerdy friends in Seattle. And when I visited them, we thought, what the hell? And we tried to recreate it.
Do you think you'd be down for an all-potato dinner?
Absolutely. I would be down for an all-potato day.
So thanks in part to Parmentier's pertinacious potato promotion, slowly France gets on board with the potato, and eventually so does the rest of Europe. About 150 years after the potato landed on European soil, it had finally taken root. And it changed the course of European history.
The overall impact is clear. For the first time, Europe is able to feed itself. You know, the mobs of hungry people stop. The granaries in the middle of cities aren't guarded by, you know, armed men. And Europe is able to get on its feet. And that has an awful lot to do with the potato. It's pretty clear that absent the potato, the history of Europe would be really, really different.
Wow. That blows my mind.
One little tuber.
Super tuber.
So is this changing your POV, your potato view?
Yeah. It you know, makes the medieval recipe look a little close-minded, if I'm honest. There's this whole new path to go down, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a medieval cookbook from Europe. Like, maybe I find an ancient cookbook from Peru.
If you're into that, we have some inspiration for you.
Oh, yeah. I am here for that.
Maria said across Peru, people still make an ancient potato recipe, one that dates back to well before your potato-less hair stew. And it hasn't gone the way of medieval European cooking because this recipe doesn't suck.
Absolutely. It's called Pachamanca, which means earth pot, because ancient Peru, pre-ceramic, used to cook everything in hot soil or hot rocks. And when I was growing up, that was the party thing. Usually to celebrate the 1st of May, which is when the potato and the corn harvest are on. First, you build a little igloo and heat up the rocks. And in the meantime, you prepare all the things you're going to put in it. Meat wrapped in leaves, corn cakes wrapped in corn leaves, and potatoes are put at the bottom with hottest rocks and the meat on top, and the corn cakes and fava beans on top. And you put grass on top to give it flavor. And then you cover it with earth to keep it sealed. And in about half an hour, everything is cooked. So it's pre-ceramic, but still a very fantastic way to cook.
Okay, yeah, that sounds way better.
Do you think your husband could get on board for that?
If I tell him how old the recipe is, he'll totally be down.
If you have a burning question you can't find an answer to, give us a ring. 833-RING-ELT. 833-RING-ELT.
Every Little Thing is produced by Caitlin O'Keefe, Stephanie Werner, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Scored by Bobby Lord, Emma Munger, and Dara Hirsch. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Super Tuber. Super Goober. I'm a super goober tuber. Fare thee well.